Hello, this is Emily Gallagher, and it is June 9th, 2013, and we are in the Solaris conference room space in Hudson, New York. And I'm about to conduct a life history interview with Deirdre Grant. So I'm going to turn it over to you to introduce yourself. How would you introduce yourself, Deirdre?
My name is Deirdre Grant. Oh, to tell something about myself. I have three main interests in life, although I consider them interrelated, and that's the environment, agriculture, and peace and justice issues. Yeah. Well, that's it. Okay, you wanna turn that off? 'Cause I'm not really
Oh no,
off.
okay. We're just, giving people space to talk, add things on if you want. So I always kind of leave a little ellipsis there,
Right,
but
okay.
that doesn't mean you have to fill it if you don't
Oh,
want.
to,
Yeah.
oh, okay. No, because I guess what I was expecting is that you would be asking questions,
Oh
you
yeah.
know.
So
Yeah,
yeah, so it's really
and so
Well, I can ask you questions if you prefer that.
yeah,
Okay.
because I'm not really comfortable.
Okay, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, you just let me know what you need to be comfortable. So,
Okay.
all right. So, let's start with the first of your three interests, which was the environment, right?
Right.
So, tell me about how you became interested in environment issues.
I was attending a program at City College in New York City called Urban Legal Studies Program. It's a pre-law program. And we had to do, initially, I was thinking, just plain civil rights law where you defend clients who were incarcerated unjustly. But then we had to do internships, and I had two. The first one was at New York City Department of Health on environmental issues. It was just becoming relevant then. It was 1980s, and how it was impacting the health of people in New York City. That was just categorizing information. Researching and categorizing information and giving the stats back to the department. The second, which inspired me to find out even more, the second environmental internship was at the United Nations, and my responsibility was to collect American environmental laws that could be given to countries in Africa, so that they could use them in their legal system to protect themselves from national corporations. And by that time, I knew enough to know how what the environmental problems were and how people were being impacted, and so that became my heartfelt social justice issue. Fortunately, something had happened with my daughter. She was about to graduate from high school, senior year, and there would have been a conflict. So I didn't go on to law school. In fact, we had three children about to go to school, college in succession. So it was just, just no way that everybody could go. But I never lost interest, and I kept up with the issues. And eventually, when we started looking at getting out of New York City, we both came from, my husband and I both came from rural areas. I came from a small town in Pennsylvania called Aliquippa, which was a rural town, and he came from Deer Park, Long Island, which at the time that he was growing up was rural. But both areas became suburban, neon lights and strip malls and all sorts of stuff. And that's not what we wanted to return to. We wound up coming to Columbia County, which is more rural than city or suburban. And we had made up our minds that, you know, because both of our, her, his mother and my grandmother both grew their own vegetables and shopped at local stores. So the concept of shopping locally and growing your own food was, we never became accustomed to the supermarket. We had to use it because we both had to work, but so we decided that's what we wanted to do. And once I said, oh, okay, great, I'm going to take the biodynamic management program at Hawthorne while I'm up here, and thinking that all I had to do in terms of the physical aspect of it was just to put a organic seed in the ground and it would grow. All I had to do was manage it, so I would just take this management, management course. And lo and behold, the first... The class was in the fall and the winter session, 3 or 4 hours a day, Saturdays. And it took me about 3 or 4 Saturdays before I even understood the lingo, because I'd have to write it down, run home. And so I began to understand there was a lot more involved. They have something called... the concept of Agriculture 1, Agriculture 2, and Agriculture 3. Agriculture 1 is when people, no matter where they were on the globe, you know, they grew things naturally based on the seasons, you know, based on the weather, based on the soil, but they didn't necessarily know why. They just... by tradition, that's what they did. So if something happened to change circumstances, in a drought or something like that, they didn't know how to adjust. Agriculture, too, is what is considered now the conventional agriculture, the use of pesticides, and you know, which you literally means you're eating toxic waste when you're eating food. And you know, there have been health consequences of that. So Agriculture 3 is going back to the natural way, but now farmers are becoming educated about how to do it so that they can make adjustments if something unusual happens. And that becomes vitally important with climate change. They've decided to change the terminology from global warming to global climate disruption. The reason being that there are other things happening besides the earth becoming warm, and farmers have to adjust to that. They have to decide on how, you know, where, based on wherever they live, how they can acclimate themselves to what is going on. The process is mitigation and adaptation, and if you want to avoid suffering, because the expectation is that there's going to be, it's the food shortage is going to be, they were already expecting it because of overpopulation, but food shortage is really going to be a problem if farmers don't know how to adjust how they farm. So in order to mitigate, in order to avoid the suffering, you know, all farmers need to learn how to make adjustments. So that's where I am right now. I studied the basics, you know, learning how what I needed to know about the not only the soil, but also the vegetation around the soil, the perennial, let's say, you have your foods that you want to grow organically that you want to sell commercially. But in order for it to become self-sustaining, you have to look at your entire farm. You don't just look at what it is that you're growing, you know, the things that have to support it, the trees, bushes, flowers, birds, you know, wildlife, and so forth, and how all of that interacts. So you've got to know your farm, and you also have to know your neighbor's farm and interact with your neighbor. The objective now is to try and get as much carbon out of the air and into the soil. In fact, one of the definitions of organic is having the carbon, having the right amount of carbon in the soil. That's only one of the things. But in terms of the effect of the global change, the more that more farmers can get carbon out of the air and into the soil, the more we can mitigate the global warming effect. Unfortunately, we've let it go on so long, things are already happening and they will continue to happen. Like what is happening today in 2013 is not the result of what we've done in this past year. It's what we've done 10, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So although you're starting to have more people who are understanding the change that needs to come, unfortunately, that didn't start happening until maybe the last 20 years or so. So what has happened in the past is still going to be going on. It's already 2050, they already know there's going to be a problem, a serious problem. So, but at least if more adjustments are made and people understand it, and it doesn't necessarily have to be somebody on a farm. It could be somebody living in an urban situation who becomes involved and does their part in the urban areas. I'm just relating what it is that I've been studying. That's what it is in terms of my interest in the environment and agriculture. But once I get going, I want to make sure that I really understand it. The best way for me to understand, like I said, I'm working on my business plan now. So once I do the business plan and I really start growing things and I see how things are working, I want to give myself maybe a year or two to do that. Then I want to return to socioeconomic issues. I'm concerned about those who are not in a position to do what we're doing. I'm concerned about being ready for those who are affected by it and also by those who want to learn. Mm-hmm. But at this point, I'm not ready to do that. I don't know enough yet. Because as far as I'm concerned, all I've done is read some books. I need to see. Because, naturally, once you put something into effect, you begin to understand that you need to change your concepts a little bit, So that's basically it, in terms of those three interests.
Cool. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about the rural town that you grew up in.
Oh boy, it was a great town. There's another reason I'm interested in environmental issues. Let me first tell you from a child's perspective. Mm-hmm. Me as a child, I was born in Harlem Hospital. 3 weeks later, my mother and father went back to where my mother grew up in Aliquippa, Pennsylvania. And that was because my grandmother, my mother's mother, told my father about this job opportunity at local steel mill. Aliquippa is in the Appalachia region, coal mine, steel mills. And that's what most people did. In fact, the J&L company, was looking for people and told people to come. So he went. He worked in the J&L steel mill, and it was nice, But unfortunately, for whatever reasons, my mother and father didn't get along. My father and my mother left when I was three, and I stayed there with my mother, my grandmother. That sounds sad, mm-hmm. but as a kid, you don't know, mm-hmm. And I guess it must have happened because I really didn't even remember my father. My mother had to come back because, women didn't work in steel mills, so she went back to to New York. So my excuse me, my grandmother was retired, and that's how I learned about, you know, she had everything. She didn't have animals, but she had she had grew fruit, vegetables. You know, I remember riding my tricycle under the arbor, and it was just a really, like, I think children should be, you know, grow up. We walked everywhere. I mean, she didn't even have a car. And it wasn't like, she, you know, I remember seeing her. She had, my mother told me a story about her and her brother that she was going to retire at age 50. You know, my grandmother didn't graduate from third grade. She cleaned people's houses for a living. And my mother said she didn't even realize how tremendous of an idea this was. So she said, but she sort of got an idea. She said they lived in a cinder block house that my grandmother built. And it turns out she learned it from her mother. And she built this little cinder block, nothing fancy, you know. She said her mother had started building another room onto the house. And so she and her brother were speculating about, oh, yeah, you know, one of us is going to be in that room. Turned out she rented the room so she could increase her income. And so the house started getting bigger. She kept doing the same thing. And at age 50, she was able to retire. And so eventually she wound up with these two family house and one three family house. But we're not talking, you wouldn't be able to identify it as an architectural wonder, okay? But for families who were, the thing that I remember about her is her getting up in the middle of the night to help people when they were sick, and, you know, what landlord does that?
Yeah.
You know, and again, not looking at it from a child's perspective, looking at it from an adult's perspective, she must have rented to people who were working poor. Mm-hmm. And I kind of remember everybody kind of working together, you know. And I'm saying that she built a house, but I remember people driving up, a man would drive up with the truck with the cinder blocks and the cement, and somebody down the street would come and help stir. I helped stir, you know. I mean, I thought I was stirring the cement, but you know, her putting the tar on the roof and everything. And what was so funny is the idea of a woman at that time wearing pants. And my grandmother didn't wear pants. She climbed ladders. She wore long skirts. She climbed ladders by pulling the backward skirt through her legs and up over her waist and tucking it in and climbed the ladder like that. So, you know, what was good about being with her was realizing that a woman could do anything. You know, although I didn't know how significant of a lesson that was at the time. But the unfortunate thing about it, one of the other things gives you an idea of how it was. I remember she was a member of the church and a member of the Democratic Club. And I went to meetings with her. You know, I'd sit there and people would be fussing and arguing civil rights issues and, so, you know, whatever the issues were. I didn't know what was going on. You know, all I know is I was getting soda pop out of the machine. But one thing that happened that was, I remember them collecting money for the swimming pool, because even though J&O called anybody of any race to come in, everybody lived in a segregated area. And we didn't have a swimming pool, and they decided they were going to build a swimming pool, and I remember that. So I had a sense as long as the community pulled together, things could happen. You know, I took it for granted that that's how things were supposed to be. And they believed in being local. And just to show you how it was, AMP had built a supermarket in the downtown area where everybody could go to the supermarket. And it was a big deal. And I remember her dressing me up in the Sunday clothes, you know, and it was only, you know, certain clothes you wore on Sunday. And dressing up in the Sunday clothes, and I had a little, my little patent leather shoes on, and my little anklets, and my little, you know, gloves, and the hat, everything. Everybody went to the supermarket to see this opening of the supermarket. And she walked around in it, you know, I figured you're going to be shopping in the supermarket. She never went to the supermarket again. She continued to grow her own things and go to the local butcher, you know, because at the corner where we were on the side avenues, that's where the local butcher was. And that's how she got her meat, and that was it. Now I never saw the inside of that supermarket again. She never traveled to that supermarket. She sold everything. So it was a great life. As a child, I think all children should be, you know, have that experience, the interaction with the neighbors, the attending the church. And I mean, I didn't know about God, you know, if grandma liked him, must be okay. Yeah. So, as I was growing up, something had happened to me. My mother had managed, she had done, my grandmother got really sick, although I didn't know why at the time. That was a stage in history where parents didn't necessarily share with you what was going on. And one day my mother came and got me. So it wasn't until maybe 2 or 3 years, I was like 8 or 9 when she came and got me. And it wasn't about 2 or 3 years later that I knew how serious that my grandmother was, seriously ill that my grandmother was. But so I spent the rest of my preteen and teen years living with my mother in New York City. But my mother had sent me to college. I went to what was then called Hampton Institute, is now Hampton College. And then she got sick. So I came home the end of my freshman year. I was able to complete the freshman year, came home, and had to work. Because she, you know, I mean, forget it, you know, she didn't have enough health insurance. Mm-hmm. She had something that was growing on her spine. And she had to be very careful. So it was about 3 or 4 months of that. And we still didn't know what was going on. She had pernicious, and it was just, you know. But anyway.
Be careful at the table.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. what happened is that I saw I had friends in the community, and what I was noticing is that they were going to work, but then they would go to school at night. So I said, well, that's what I'll do, you know. And I tried it. I started in September, and by about November, I was exhausted, totally and completely exhausted. And I really could not figure out why everybody else could do what I wasn't able to do. Well, years later, I mean, I was 55 before somebody was able to tell me that I had asthma. And so possibly if I'd had the right medication and the right diagnosis, I might have been able to do it. But I was not able to do that. And I would find there would be several times that I would start a job and not be able to really complete it. You know, because I'm the type of person, I'll work overtime, especially if it's, you know, and most, I've always worked in some sort of social service field. But what happened about, I guess, 10 years ago, and was it that? No. 2001, 2002, I read an article. Aliquippa had that project that they had everybody coming to Aliquippa about was a part of an undercover project to make uranium things for the government. to make the bomb, the Manhattan Project. And the article was saying, this is U.S. News and World Report, what the article was saying was that people had become sick. The Superfund, which is the America's thing for cleaning up, had not been used successfully even at that point. This was 2001, 2002. The consequence of that, putting together the uranium bars or whatever they were doing, was that, and they weren't handling it right at the time. The project lasted from 1947, the year I was born in, until 1951. So when my mother and father left, this had been going on, and I was there at a time when this had started as an infant. The soil that my grandmother was growing that food in the air had impacted the soil. So people had become sick, very sick, and the government at that time, fortunately, under Nixon, the environmental laws, they started acknowledging certain things. But the Superfund that was used to even clean it up in the 1990s or whatever, even at 2002, had not done it successfully. When one of the reasons why it took so long for anybody to find out that I had the asthma that I had is because whatever the testing was that was done, in fact, the doctor that my husband and I took me all over the place trying to figure out. We went from Jersey to Massachusetts trying to figure out. The doctors would say, you're having difficulty breathing, you're not getting enough oxygen, but it's not showing as asthma, but we can't tell you what it is. And then finally, a doctor through Helen Hayes Hospital in Rockland County said to me, where'd you grow up? And I told him. And this was before I had even read the article. And he said, he put me in a room with a lot of equipment and had me go to the circuit. And he says, you definitely got asthma. He says, I'm sending you to an ENT doctor. I had, what is that condition with the nose? Anyway, I had an operation. I was able to at least, the medicine, I could use it. Now, you know, and so that made a difference, and I had to go through physical therapy for 6 weeks. But the point here is that once I could tell what kind of problem that I was having, and that a lot of it had to do with what had happened to the people in Aliquippa, and it wasn't just Aliquippa, it was other cities too. Once that I found that out, that really, really deepened my commitment to environmental issues, because there's no way in the world that a government, anybody, any corporation, any government should be able to do that to people and not tell them. And only the people who worked in the mines are able to benefit from the winning of the cases, you know. So. My father developed severe asthma. Mm. So the government knew it. He was a veteran. He left and he went into, he was in the Korean War. And the government knew how to test. So they were able to identify it for him. And I mean, I never really saw him after that. I saw him again when I was 21 or so. But anyway, so that's where a deepened connection came in, because I think that children should learn from a very young age how to protect themselves, how to recognize when there's potential danger. Should know enough about their local government to question things when something comes in. Know that they should participate in the community process. I feel like I'm going all over the place, but so that's where that deepened commitment came to, and the fact I think about how sick my grandmother became. And I can't help but, I mean, she was the last person in the world that deserved that. Mm-hmm. You know, she was the last person in the world deserved. I can't say for certain that that's what happened. But it's difficult for me to believe that the woman that I saw bending over in the soil and, you know, raking and hoeing and, you know, putting the seeds in and all that sort of stuff. And now, see, she wouldn't have known about soil testing, which is, again, points out the difference between Agriculture 1 and Agriculture 2. She wouldn't have known to know that she had to test that soil. Had anybody there, the people that she bought the meat from at the local butcher, you know, if they had known, you know, because the people who own the butcher are the people who farm the animals, you know, and so if that's why it becomes extremely important for farmers to know why they're doing what they're doing, and to so I wish there was a way to take agricultural students and just take them around and explain things to people, you know. I, you know, my head has been so deep in these books in the last 2 years. That's about the only thing I know to talk about. But I don't know what else to say right now.
What was it like for you when you had to move from Pennsylvania to New York City? How did you feel?
It was traumatic. It was absolutely traumatic. It's funny because my mother and my grandmother are like, were totally two different people. And what's strange is that my daughter and I are totally different people. But I think what it is that because I had that experience, I knew that it was important for me to validate her. That it was okay that she and I are not the same type of person. It's not that we're not the same. We have similar values. But wealth for me means land and I love being in a rural area. She loves being in an urban area. She announced to me when she was 3 years old that she wanted to become a doctor, and made up her mind that she was going to do well in school. Did well in school, managed to get into. In fact, we were living on Long Island, and she said to me, "In New York City, you can get to a gifted and talented program, and you know they have pre-med classes." I don't know where, because, I mean, the internet wasn't available then. I don't know where she got it from. But anyway, we moved back into Queens. And by this time, she had found some friend in Queens, and she lived with him for a year so she could qualify to get into the junior high school, because you had to go into the high school. This is how young she was. And you had to qualify to get into from the junior high school to get into these high school with the pre-med program. But make a long story short, turned out that we were in church one Sunday. She was in her senior year in high school, and she had told my husband and I she was going to be a doctor. All this time now, we were planning on her going to school to become a doctor, and she said, your pastor had all the high school graduates, kids were about to graduate, to stand up and, you know, tell what they were going to do. And she said, oh, I'm going to be a lawyer and I'm going to major in Japanese. I was like, Phil and I looked at each other like, what? So she said, yeah. I said, oh, Medea, did you mind letting us know that you had changed your mind? She said, yeah. She said, you know, that time that, because they took them to farms and stuff. And, it gets to some idea of what it's like physically handling a patient. And she said, sticking my fist inside a cow, I realized it. That wasn't exactly for me. And having to suck the pig just, you know, wasn't for me. So I decided, you know. But the reason why she wanted to, she chose the profession. I'm thinking, no, she's really dedicated to being a doctor. So becoming a lawyer was like, what? So she had made up her mind that she wanted to have a lot of money, and these are two professions that. So I had never thought I love to learn. I love to learn. So I assume my child loved to learn, right? I mean, she could learn, but she was going to have a lot of money. You know, and I guess I should have realized it because she, you know, loves jewelry and, you know, she goes to get her nails done and all that sort of stuff. And I mean, which is fine. And I made sure that is this what makes you happy? Then I'm gonna make sure that you do it. But the thing that was difficult for me coming to live with my mother, she came from a generation where if a parent said you do this, you do that, you know. And I came into Brooklyn. You know, we lived in a one room, and so now I've gone from living in a house that was not really a house, it was like a compound of houses, you know, with neighbors who knew who I was, and you know, people identifying me as Cora Harmon's grandbaby. You know, it was just totally different. It was not a family atmosphere at all. Fortunately, I got into the school. The public school was right down the block at the end of the corner. And I was in the third grade when I it was second grade. And I was, they called my mother up to the school and she said, you know, why are they calling me up to the school? I said, I have no idea. And they told her they wanted me to take a test to get into, they didn't call it gifted and talented then, they called it special progress, to get into a special progress program. Unfortunately, there was only one school in Brooklyn that had it. So now, not only am I in a city environment, I've got to travel to take, I had to take, at first it was two, a train and a bus, two buses. I had to transfer on the bus. It was just awful. It was just awful. I could not stand it, you know, and I felt like somebody was being mean to me. But I mean, it was the best that my mother could do at the time. She would eventually get her real estate license, and we moved to Queens, which made life, you know, a lot better. But so I never really adapted, you know. I did what I had to do. I went to school. You know, I was always somebody that participated in clubs and things like that. But all the time, there's this tension in my head. You know, I remember once walking down the block with my mother, and it was not too long after we got here, and you know, I'm saying hello to everybody. She said, "You cannot do that. You know, you cannot talk to everybody on the street." So it was just a totally different atmosphere. You know, a totally different atmosphere. I just never became accustomed to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because even now we moved. Phil and I brought together a Brady Bunch type family, and I don't know if you're young, so Brady Bunch was a program on TV with, you know, step families together. So we're a Brady Bunch type family. We had lived out in Long Island until, you know, Radia got, and my daughter got accepted into that program. But even in the suburbs, I felt uncomfortable. Just something wasn't, and it's funny because it was several years before the two of us even talked about how uncomfortable each of us was. And
you and Phil?
Yeah, yeah. You know, because I'm thinking, because the house that he grew up in was not that far from where I was living, and his house sat on maybe about 2 or 3 acres. So I'm thinking, oh, that's the closest thing to what I've ever seen. You know, it's like, oh boy, and he says, yeah, but he said, but what happened is that the spring that went through it was so polluted that the fish stopped. Because factories, they had started putting up factories, and So by the time, but unfortunately, the jobs were in the city. So we both had to travel into the city to work. It was just not, to me, it's like an alien life, you know? That's how strange it was to me. I did it, but, you know, it was just an alien life. And when she moved in, he had started a business. We did okay, but then about 1980-something or another, the recession hit. And he used his skills he learned in the service to install business machines, particularly fax machines. Fax machines at one time was something exclusively to businesses, mm-hmm. you know, and it wasn't something that you just bought in your house and just, you know, stuck in. You really had to know how to install them. So he was doing very well at one point in the Wall Street area because that's where he had done salesmen. So he had a lot of people that he knew, and they, you know, so his business was doing fine. But when the recession hit, a lot of business because he didn't have he serviced Goldman Sachs and stuff, but most of his business was the small companies, and they left the city. So we wound up having to move back into Brooklyn. I'm like, oh my goodness. So we put his office and our housing situation in the same place. But no, I never adjusted. So I feel like when I said to you the other day, I feel like I'm home now. Mm-hmm. I feel like this is the way life is supposed to be. You know, I think this is the way children are supposed to be raised. Yeah, even a town like Hudson. It was interesting to hear other people describe Hudson because it's not my experience. And then I had to realize that I was telling you about the experiences that we had living in the city with our two boys, mm-hmm. and even with Phil, at a certain age, African American males are treated differently than African American females. And I didn't really realize that until my boys had had a deeper voice and, you know, grew a certain height and, you know, got the broad shoulders and stuff. But how I became aware that there was a problem was when Phil would tell me about taking it, because he would carry his equipment on a cart and going into these buildings in the Wall Street area and having people at the desk say to him, you know, where are you going? You know, and just treating him as though he was there to rob somebody, mm-hmm. or he would be on the, you know, because now we're not talking about somebody dressed like, you know, with $400 or $500 suits, you know. And he would get on the elevator, and it was just, I could tell when he would come home that he'd had a bad, you know, that something had happened, and it took a while for him to start telling me how the people in the lobby would treat him, or even when he would get to the office, and, you know, the women behind, I'm saying women, most of receptionists mm-hmm. behind the desk would say to him, you know, what do you want, you know, and they'd have, like, one finger on the dial, and, you know, just acting as though he was there to rob them or something. The young lady had asked me, you know, well, what else had happened? I remember this was when we had two sons. The older one is slim built, but again, you could tell when he was turned 13 or so that, you know, he was developing into a male. And we put him in an acting program. We didn't put it. He said that he wanted to be in it. We lived in Queens. The acting program was in Manhattan, and so he would take the subway in. and he had made a friend from going in to see him in different things. We had become friends with the parents. And one day he came in and said the friend lived in Manhattan also. He said, I want to have, his friend was having a birthday party, and could he go? So I said, well, I don't mind you coming home on a Saturday in the afternoon, but I definitely don't want you coming on the subway, that late at night. I said, I like them, so he arranged to spend the night. And so I said, but the thing of it is you're still expected to get home in time enough to go to church in the morning. Because it was important at that stage because he was in a confirmation class. Mm-hmm. So he did that, came home on the subway, got home, walked in the door in time enough for us to, get ready and go. And I could tell something was troubling. I said, well, what's the matter? And he said, Mom, he said, I stopped in the store when you come up out of the subway, and the guy told me that I had stolen his comic book. He had the comic book rolled up in his back pocket, and he took it from me. Well, I said, well, we didn't have a car at the time. I said, I called for a taxi for us to go back up there, all of us to go back up there. And I went up there, and I said the guy recognized this right away. Now, the place, the size of the place, it was a hole in the wall. It was where you sell magazines and newspapers. Mm-hmm. So in the city, when you have that, generally those places are smaller than a 9x10 room. I mean, there's nowhere in the place that you can go that somebody doesn't see you. So I said to the person, my son said that you took the comic book from him. And he said, yeah, I got it right here. So I said to Rashid, I said, is this the comic book that you had? And he said, yeah. So I said to the man, I said, open up the page. Open up to where the crossword puzzle is. And he opened it up, and it was all completed. And I said, the reason why I'm up here is, I said, I'm not saying that my child won't do anything, but there's certain things that I know that my child will do. And one of them is, I know as soon as he gets a comic book, he's going to do the puzzle in it. That's what he mainly gets the comic book for. And I said, the fact that he was in here and you could see that he was here, he said, oh, I'm so sorry. I said, no, the damage is done. The damage is done. You've accused him of something that he didn't do. How am I supposed to take him to church? And you're making false accusations. I said, I'm not leaving here until you apologize to him. So he did. But there were several incidents like that. How in the world can you assume that this child walked in the door? And it happens, there's too many stories that I've had with other mothers and fathers that tells me, I don't hear those stories. I'm sorry, I don't hear those stories from white parents. Okay? Mm-hmm. I only hear them from African-American mm-hmm. stories. And then you wonder why young men get angry. I let my sons know that can't be the excuse. You got to be better than that. But you can definitely see them change. And he did say he was sorry. What I wanted my son to see was that you don't have to resort to anything violent. You don't have to, and certainly by all means, anytime something like this happens, you come home and you tell us straight away. There was no way in the world I would have wanted to go to church knowing that somebody had falsely accused him of something. Now, if he did something he had no business doing, that's one thing. I mean, if he had actually done it, that's one thing. But I knew enough to know how I could prove whether or not. I didn't even tell my son what I was going to ask him. Because if I had told him, that I'm going to look for that crossword puzzle and he hadn't really filled it in and he had really taken that book, then, you know, he would have known to try and make excuses. So I did it for that way for that reason, to make sure that I knew that he had been falsely accused. And the incident with something similar happened with the younger one. We went to we were in the Long Island Railroad Station, similar to the Metro North here in Long Island, and to get tickets. And the man, he didn't realize that my son had his parents there. And he talked to him like he was the worst thing on the face of the earth. Just, you know, get away from here. You know, just. And I walked over to him. I had to do the same thing, too. I had to have the man apologize. I don't know how many times things may have happened that we didn't see. Mm-hmm. So that's why it was very important that we raised them in a way that we always made sure that our house was open to all their friends. Everybody came over, you know, for holidays and all that. But that was part of the reason why, is because I wanted to create that kind of insulation that, but you know, you can't protect your kids all the time. So I just, you know, I was looking, when we were looking for a place to go to, it wasn't just a rural area. We looked a lot of places. It had to be a welcoming community, a community where we felt comfortable, a community where when my kids come to visit, they feel comfortable. And Columbia County did that for us. And, you know, even coming, because, you know, because of who my daughter is, I mean, she can't stay out there on. So I like to bring her into Hudson. She feels comfortable here. You know, her husband feels comfortable here. So that becomes that. And when I say to you, we traveled all over looking for that combination, rural and welcoming. I'd say and this took 2 or 3 years of traveling around looking for that combination. And I'd say there may have been 2 or 3 on our list of where to go. And finally we decided on Columbia County. So now I'm home.
What triggered your search? What was the moment when you said, okay, now we get to look for a new home?
About when Phil and I used to, that's when we realized, because we used to ride our bikes around the city. And go into different neighborhoods, and you know, because you have the one good thing about New York City is that you have the Italian community, Chinese community, Hasidic community, you know, and they are so accustomed to seeing other ethnic groups that when you come in, they're not they're receptive, and so we still like to do that. And at some point, I couldn't get on the bike anymore. I was just too exhausted. We took the bikes out. I got off. We traveled maybe about a block and a half, and I said, Phil, I just can't. I don't know what the problem is, but I just can't do it anymore. So we stopped doing this. So what we started doing on the weekends, because by this time, all 3 kids are in college. we started traveling outside, little jaunts, different areas. And we went to a place in Pennsylvania that one of those places, we like to stumble upon places. We were driving down a rural area with a lot of trees, and there was a park there. And I don't know why I decided I wanted to go in that particular park, but there was an entrance. We went to the park, and when you kept going past the admission gate, there was a waterfall, really high waterfall, and there were steps leading down. Well, it was a path leading down to the bottom of the waterfall, and that was the first time in years I felt like I could breathe. You know, it was the water coming off, and between the tall trees and the water, I felt my lungs felt like, you know, they weren't burning, you know. Well, it's not that they felt like they were burning. They just, I felt, it's hard to describe, but I just felt like I could breathe, you know. And I realized I needed to be someplace where the air was clean, you know. Being in New York City, the air is not clean. And so at that point, I said, Phil, you know, I got to get out. Because I can't, now that I know that this is not normal, now that I know that I could feel better, I know that I have to get out of here. So we just started driving around, looking in different, at first we thought of Pennsylvania because of that circumstance, but see, that's where the towns were not, don't misunderstand, nobody was ever downright rude, you know, but you just know that you're not comfortable in this situation. And so we started, and you know, I felt a little sentimental because it was Pennsylvania. You know, I grew up in Pennsylvania. But we didn't find anything there. We drove to the area around Ithaca, you know, Cornell, because I like to be close to colleges and stuff. And where else did we go? We even went as far as we went down to, where did we go? We went to West Virginia. Well, that just, that was the thought there was that my daughter now lives in Washington, D.C., so we were thinking about what was affordable for us, you know, close to there. And West Virginia seemed affordable, but that definitely was not the place for us. So we went to Massachusetts, loved the Berkshire County, but it's way too expensive to live over there. So, interestingly enough, at some point, because the schools had become so bad in where we were in New York, our first son went, the older of the two boys, went into the, now remember, she was accepted into the gifted and talented, so she's in a little insulated thing in the public school system. So, you know, I'm not worried about her. But we tried it with, we figured we'd just give him all the support we could, the older of the two boys, we'd give him all the support we could in the school system. But the school system was not able to give the kids the type of education that they needed. So, we hunted around and found the Hoosick School up here in Rensselaer County. And it finally occurred to us, we're driving through this area that we like. Maybe we need to drive off the highway, off the Taconic, and drive into it and see what's going on up there. Well, we weren't that crazy about Rensselaer County, but we loved Columbia County. So that's why how we wound up in Columbia County. Yeah, so. In fact, the first face I saw was somebody who smiles just like you do, broad smile, you know, very, very welcoming, you know, and so I haven't regretted it a day. We've been here for 3 years now. I haven't regretted a day of it. Wouldn't change it for the world. Just as happy, you know, just as happy, so that's how we wound up here.
How old are your kids now?
38. Okay, let me stop. 37, 38, and 40. Oh, God, she, for her, that's, you know, terrible. Oh, my God, Mom, I'm going to be 40 years old. I said, oh, gee, welcome to the club. What can I tell you? And, yeah, she's 40.
Did she become a lawyer? Did she?
Yeah. She did. She became an attorney, and still doesn't have enough money as far as she's concerned. But it was so funny. Her first internship, she comes in. She was doing it during the summer, and Phil said to her, She was saying to Phil, gee, I don't have enough money for something she needed to get, and he was reaching in his pocket and giving it to her. And so she walked out. I said, Phil, have you seen her paycheck? he said, no. I said, honey, she's earning as more than we are together for an internship. So she may not know that she's fine, but she's fine. She's fine. She's doing just fine, you know. All she's got to do is not want as much, you know. Mm-hmm. So I figure she'll, what I'm seeing with her children is she's understanding what the priorities are, you know. So, you know, you can't teach everything at once. Mm-hmm. And some things you begin to realize just aren't that important. So, you know, we're able to, we're doing pretty good, you know. She's doing pretty good. So it's the boys, unfortunately, didn't finish college. They started, but they didn't finish. They're doing okay, though. Mm-hmm. You know, they're doing okay. So, you know, everybody understands the value of work, working hard, setting goals. You know, so I have really nothing to complain about. Mm. You know, life is. Especially now that I'm not in the city anywhere. It's fine. It's fine. So, I don't even use my asthma equipment every day. I don't have to use it every day. That's a real big blessing. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm happy about that.
So I am curious how you came to meet Phil.
Oh boy, that is some story. just how we got to Long Island. A friend of mine bought a house on Long Island. We were living. I was living with the two younger children. Mm-hmm. Are my biological children. Mm-hmm. And I was living with their father. We were married also. Mm-hmm. We lived with their father in Queens, and we met a couple who decided to move out to Long Island. Anyway, she and I became very close friends, so we moved out to Long Island. I said, well, at least that's not the city. And anyway, that marriage ended, so it was just myself and the kids. And my son made friends with this little boy, and their personalities just suited each other, you know. They loved it was like you would give them a shower in the morning, and 10 minutes later they were filthy. What's that character what is it? Pigpen?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Charlie Brown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I said, under my breath, Pigpens. So, but they, you know, played in the dirt and all that sort of stuff, and I just loved both of them, you know. And my daughter couldn't figure out what we needed them for. But anyway, both Phil and I, not knowing each other then, took our kids to sign up for, name a team. They both played baseball, football. And so whatever the season was, for about two and a half years or so, we would see each other. And then one day, the boy came to me and said that his mother had gone to the hospital. I didn't know it, but his mother had suffered from mental illness. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking, you know, she's physically ill. And he said, my father's at the supermarket. He didn't have a way to get to the supermarket. Mm-hmm. So I drove him there, and I said, you know, your wife is in the hospital. And Phil said, oh, she hasn't been taking her meds. And that's when I found out that she was, you know, had the problem. So we became friends. But to make his wife wound up staying, becoming institutionalized. Mm-hmm. And he, the two of them, my son and my son now, started gee, we wish you two would get married. So it was them that really made us start thinking about, you know, even talking to one another. And eventually we wound up being together. And then they fought like cats and dogs after we got together. You know, I said, Phil, I don't understand what happened. He says, because they're siblings now.
You know, careful what you wish for, right? Right?
But yeah, they all, yeah. I wish your mother was my mother. I wish your father was my father. You know, that's how, you know. So that's how we got together.
That's such a nice story.
Yeah. My daughter said, well, you know, it's, you and Phil are fine, but I just don't understand why we have to have those two. Yeah, that's how we got together.
Yeah. What are some of your hopes for the future?
Like I said, what I want to do now is, you know, get the actually turn what I've been reading into reality, of actually turning it into a farm. Unlike my grandmother, I also want animals. Mm. Not a lot, but just, you know, some. And knowing that I know enough to share the information with other people, I was thinking about turning, I'd like to start a nonprofit that could set up some sort of model to inform people about what's going on and how they can, you know, take care of themselves. And it was interesting because the first job that I had was working in the weatherization department for New York State. I was a field assessor going into houses, crawling through attics and everything else, trying to, well, you know, it was for people who were below a certain income in order for them to get to weatherize their houses. You know, for whatever reasons, an elderly person on Social Security, you couldn't afford windows and doors and roofing and stuff. And I loved it. You know, it's funny because I didn't think about it at the time. I was older before I realized, of course, you know, I was with my grandmother climbing up ladders and everything else. So, you know, and it was so funny because I didn't even know to look for the job. Somebody said to me, how would you like to do, you know, weatherization? You put, all I was told is that you get to put windows in people's houses, you know, who can't afford them. And I love that concept. So I said, okay, fine. And then nobody told me that I was going to have to, you know, crawl around. I eventually became weatherization director for the program. But then after we moved into the city, you know, that was just entirely too far because are you familiar with Suffolk and Massillon and Suffolk? Yeah, so we were way out in Suffolk County. So, and eventually I wound up working for an organization called Black Veterans for Social Justice. I was a property manager for, you know, putting homeless veterans in housing. And I loved that job, just loved it. You know, and that's another thing with the reason why there had to be. I never had the experience of trying to help through the VA for the government's Veterans Administration, but unfortunately, a lot of times people in any kind of community don't realize what process they have to go through. I don't think a veteran should have to beg the Veterans Administration to help them, you know. But for a number of reasons, the VA didn't have enough employees to do what needed to be done to find these veterans. Nobody from the VA is going to come into Bed-Stuy looking for a homeless veteran. So I guess this is why the gentleman who started the organization did it. And nobody was not admitted because they weren't black. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing I liked, you know. It's just that we happen to be in Bed-Stuy. And so I just, you know, and what I liked was the insistence that the property be well taken care of. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't have to, just because they were in the conditions they were in didn't mean that they had to be in, I'm talking about the founder of the program, his attitude was they should be in decent housing. you know, something pleasant to be in, something that they could participate in. Because once a month, part of the what was different about, because I had to be trained to be a property manager. What was different in this situation is a property manager usually goes and checks and makes sure that everything's okay structurally and safety issues and sanitary issues are taken care of. And that's usually just about it. You know, the buildings are well maintained and so forth. But the component of it that I really liked is once a month you met with the tenants and let them air their issues. In fact, coming into the program, they understood that they were going to be responsible for not only their area, but the public areas. And they got to tell you what was happening. You visited, you were assigned, because it was like 7 property managers, there were a lot of buildings. You were assigned to certain clients in each building. And so you were responsible for going and seeing them once a month. And there were certain things that you were looking for to determine if they were having a problem that they couldn't articulate. So you were involved with them not only in the sense of your being a landlord and helping them, you know, making sure that they lived in decent quarters, but also you were involved if they looked like they were sick, were having any particular social issues. And as a matter of fact, that's when I first found out that female veterans were raped while they were in the service. I forgot what your question was.
I asked if you had a hope for the future. Yeah, you're talking about things that you
liked. That I want to. That's veterans is something I want to revisit at some point. You know, I'm not exactly sure. Because they really don't. They deserve better care than what they're getting. You know, I can't really say that it's all the government's fault that they're not getting it, but whatever. You can't think of people who don't mind working. Mm-hmm. You know, and so if there are some of them who are interested in farming or something like that, that's, you know, that's what I would like to get them involved in. I remember there was a few even then that I thought, oh gee, they really need to get out of an urban environment. There was a man, I said to one of the other property men, I said, look at him. I said, he seems physically healthy. He's, you know, very articulate, very friendly, and very courteous. I said, you know, he how come he can't work? Because, you know, most of them worked. Some of them didn't. Usually it was somebody who you could see was physically disabled, you know, mm-hmm. who couldn't. But this one seemed, you know, strong and strapping. He said, believe me, in less than a month you'll find out why. And sure enough, I was in the office one day, and he came in the office bawling, just crying. Mm. And I said, what's the matter? And he said, come with me. And so I went with him. And we had a new tenant move in, and the tenant was playing the radio loud. As far as he was concerned, there was the 2 Iraqi wars. Mm. He was a veteran of the first. He thought it was an enemy in the apartment, you know. And I was saying, gee, I wish, this was before I even thought about Columbia County or anything else. I was saying, gee, I wish there was a way I could take some of these guys and just take them out of hearing all that, you know, let them hear birds and, you know. So I thought about, trying to revisit the veteran issue and thinking about a way to... None of this is definite now, but I do that. That's what I'd like to do. I'd like to revisit that possibility.
Yeah. Sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's just pray and hope I can pull it off.
Yeah. You know. It's always hard to see the the path, right, to get there. But
yeah. Let me put the first, put that first seed in the ground.
Manage it.
Yeah.
Well, it was so great to talk to you. Fantastic stories to tell.
Thank you so much. Oh, no problem.
No problem.
Now it's my turn.
Okay, well, let me turn off the recorder.
Oh, that's not fair.
Oh, I know.